Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. On today's episode, we bring you stories about danger, and we'll begin with West Virginia teller Bill Lepp and a story called Diablo, or How I Met My Wife. It's bound to be a wild ride. Here's Bill.
Thank you very much. A lot of people ask me how I met my wife. A lot of people ask her, what were you thinking? We met at a camp for juvenile delinquents. And she likes me to point out quicker than that we were both counselors there. I got out of college, I needed a job, and I saw a job for camp counselor. I didn't want to buy a suit, and I didn't want to get a haircut, so I thought, let's go. And I went to North Carolina, I took this job, and this was a camp for, it wasn't a boot camp, it's not where they march kids out into the desert until, you know, I'll change my life if you just give me a drink of water. It was an experiential education camp, and most of the kids that came to it, all of the kids that came to it, had been kicked out of school and had, let's just say, started their legal careers early. And most of them were great kids. They really were great kids who had just had the misfortune of being born to adults who were ill-equipped to be good parents. And so by the time we got them, they just needed someone who had the time and the patience to pay attention to them. And so I got hired. I went down. I did a six-week stint, and then I got sent to training because that's how they did it. So you could get a feel for it and then get the serious training. And as part of the training, we were going to go on a 10-day river trip. Now, we were down in Florida. We were going to go down the Withlacoochee to where it hits the Suwannee. And I was sitting in a tent with these 19 other camp counselor guys. We were all 21, 22-year-old recent college graduates. We were discussing manners when you're at a table. Say, please pass the, just because a condiment is on the table doesn't mean you have to put it. You don't have to have ketchup and syrup on your pancakes. If you make a rude noise, say, excuse me. And again, we had all just graduated from college, so this was solid information for us. And we were waiting for this replacement counselor to come in who was going to go on this river trip with us. I had my head down. I was talking to my buddy Eric. And somebody walked in the tent and said, how you boys doing? And let me just tell you, it was right up there with the most amazing voice. It's tied with the most amazing voice I'd ever heard because it sounded exactly like Holly Hunter in Raising Arizona. And I had a huge crush on Holly Hunter. And so I thought to myself, that is the most beautiful. I can't look at this woman because there's no way she's as beautiful as that voice. And if I look at it, it's just going to ruin the whole situation. And then, you know, if she is, it's going to be one of those Dame Ragnell situations where, you know, Sir Gawain has to marry this woman. She's a hag. She's under a curse. And so she's really not attractive. And so, but he has to marry her. And so then he gets back to the room, and she turns into a beautiful woman, and she says, I'm under a curse. She says, but here's the thing. I can either be beautiful with you when everybody can see us, and then ugly when we're alone, or I can be ugly in public where everybody can see us, and beautiful when we're alone. You have to decide. And I thought, I don't want to make that decision, right? So, but I had to look. Oh my gosh, she was just as beautiful as she sounded. And I said to my buddy, Eric, I said, Eric, I am going to marry that woman. Now, Eric says that that's like the 17th time I'd said that about various women in the last 3 days. I can test that, but even, you know, if it's true, I was right once. So we go on this river trip, and we get down. We're on the Withlacoochee, and we pull into this campsite, and in the campsite next to us, there's all these people with horse trailers. They were the Suwannee County Riding Club. And they said, do you guys want to come over and eat hot dogs? And we've been eating freeze-dried camping food. And my buddy Chris was like, ooh, hot dogs, fresh meat. Yeah, if you've ever wondered how long you have to go without fresh meat to consider a hot dog fresh meat, 4 days. And so we went over, we had a good time with them. And then they said, in the morning, would you like to go on a horse ride? And we were like, yes, we would. So we got up in the morning and we were walking over there. And I was thinking, they asked me if I wanted to ride a horse. What they didn't ask me is, do you know how to ride a horse. Of course I knew how to ride a horse. Had I ever ridden a horse? I don't think so. But I was a 21-year-old American male, right? I had grown up watching John Wayne and Kevin Costner movies. Of course I knew how to ride. It doesn't matter that my family didn't get here till 1921. When my grosspapa got off the boat at Ellis Island, they just injected him with cowboy DNA. Of course I knew how to ride a horse. I mean, I was thinking, how hard can it be, right? I mean, a horse is like a bicycle for lazy people. You don't even have to pedal. You just get on, you go, and it goes. So I get to where the horses are, and here's this woman, and she's like, come here, come here. You should ride this horse. Now, this horse was the largest single land mammal I have ever seen. It was half giraffe, half horse, and half elephant. That's how big it was. And I was like, yeah. Of course I should ride this horse. And so I got in the cherry picker. And they lifted me up to the saddle. And I was up there on this horse. And all the other horses way down below me, they were just milling around, drinking water, eating grass, whatever. Now, what I would learn later, a couple of things. One is that this woman, she knew how to ride a horse. During college, she worked every summer at a horse camp. And she and her co-counselors played ultimate frisbee on horseback. Yeah, she knew how to ride a horse. And then, later, I would learn that this horse was named Diablo. Now, my command of the Spanish language was not then what it is now. And I did not know that Diablo meant devil. But I thought, even if I had known that, I would have thought, oh, they call this horse Diablo because he's some sort of mild-mannered, good-natured horse that it's like an ironic... No. It wasn't an ironic name. The other horses were milling around. This horse, I could just feel him winding up. And then the other horses started to walk away. And the owner of my horse was holding onto the reins like an anchor. And when the other horses were 100 yards away, that's when I would start to learn that Diablo would suffer almost any injury, almost any insult, except being behind another horse. And when the other horses were 100 yards away, the owner let go of the reins. And Diablo took off so fast that the back pockets of my pants just came off and floated to the ground. That's why people ask me all the time why I stand like this on stage. And it's because I now have a deep-seated fear that something underneath of me is going to suddenly accelerate. And my whole rear end might come off. So I just keep a tight grip on it. Now, I wasn't riding Diablo. I was just holding on to Diablo because, you know, I knew I could die, but I was trying to impress a hot chick. Now I know we can't say hot chick. I was trying to impress a woman of attractive descent. And so I was just holding on, and the other horses were turning onto this path that was raised up off the forest floor. It was done by, like, the CCC or convicts, you know, somebody that had a lot of time. It was raised up, and then there was sand on it because everything on the trail was beautiful, but everything off the trail, there were sprawling live oak trees and palmetto bushes with razor-sharp blades that just wanted to cut you in half. And there were palm trees that would just throw fronds at you. And there were inky, slow-moving Florida creeks. And there were sinkholes that would just open up and marshes. And there were agitated alligators. And there were coral snakes. And there were mosquitoes the size of dragonflies. And Diablo tore into that part of the woods while the other horses were walking on the trail. And Diablo was passing horses. He didn't care. But he thought that I was slowing him down. He thought that me being on his back, he hadn't read the same National Geographic article that I read that proved that a horse with a person on it can actually go faster with a horse without. But So he wanted me off. But this was the South, and he had that wonderful passive Southern way like my father-in-law has. He'll never tell you what to do. He'll just suggest, and you can make your own decisions based on that information. Like my father-in-law might say, Paulette, that's his wife, Paulette, we ought to go to bed so these folks can go home. And then you can just make your own decisions. So Diablo wasn't asking me to get off. He was just suggesting. He ran by a tree real on this side, and so close I had to take this leg and put it on this side of the horse. And then he ran by a tree on this side, so then I had to stand up in the saddle like that. And then he ran under an overhang, and I had to duck. And when that failed to tear me off, he jumped through the first and second strands of a barbed wire fence. And still, I hung on, and then he went through an alligator. And not in the conventional direction. And when that failed to unseat me, he flipped over, swam upside down across the river. But I held on. He was trying to drown me. We got to the other side. He popped upright. We were going, and I realized in front of us there was a tree. It was a huge live oak tree. It was like 12 feet around on the side that I could see. Who knows how big it was on the other side. And the path went right beside that tree, and Paula, this woman, was on the lead horse, and she was just at that tree, and Diablo was trying to figure out if he could get between that horse and that tree without hurting himself. But even the great Diablo didn't want to do that. On the other side of the tree, there was just a great big earth sore, just this open, gaping hole in the ground with radioactive magma coming out of it. And even Diablo didn't think he could jump that, but he wasn't slowing down, and I was like, what is going on here? And you have to understand that my heart rate was up. It was elevated. My pulse rate was near the stroke zone. And so I was trying to calm myself down. And so I started thinking about Newton's second law. Now, I don't know a lot about Newtonian laws, but I do know this. When somebody starts talking about them, my heart rate goes down, my blood pressure drops, and I fall asleep. So I was calming myself down. I was thinking to myself, Newton's second law, when a body of mass is acted upon by a force, the mass will move in the direction of the force at a speed related to the force, but inversely related to the mass, which means essentially, if I were to push a marble as hard as I could, it would move at a pretty good clip for a fair distance. Whereas, if I were to push a bulldozer with exactly the same force I pushed the marble, the bulldozer wouldn't go nearly as far. And I thought, I am not the force that's causing Diablo to accelerate. But what if I were to act on him with an unforce? Could I cause him to decelerate? And then I started to think, how would you act on something with an unforce, right? And then the yin-yang started going, and the zen kicked in, and the pressure started going down. And then it hit me, not an idea, a branch. A branch hit me. Right then, it just unforced me right off the back of Diablo. And I was falling. I managed to grab hold of his tail, and I managed to pull myself back on at the last second. I got back in the saddle, and he was running straight for this tree. And that's when I noticed that in the middle of that tree, there was a hole, like a lightning strike, like a rent, like a tear, like 3 feet wide, like 3 feet tall, maybe 2 feet wide. And Diablo, I guess, was going to try and jump through the hole in that tree instead of trying to go around it. And that's when I started thinking about miniature horses. Like, I don't know if you ever driving down the road and you see a sign that says, like, Earl's Miniature Horse Farm. And you're like, why? Why does Earl or anyone have miniature horses? Do they have a little wagon that they can't pull? Are they going to plow a small field? You know, are they fielding a miniature polo team? But now I knew why. If you're going to jump a horse through a hole in a tree, you better hope that's a miniature horse. And we were just about to jump through the hole in the tree when it hit me, this time an idea. I reached in my pocket and I pulled out my stainless steel 74 function Swiss Army type knife. And I quickly opened up the magic hat and the magic wand. And presto chango, I turned Diablo into a rabbit and we made it through the hole. And when we got to the other side, presto chango, I turned him back into a horse. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, I understand how Diablo got through the tree. He was as big as a rabbit. But how did you get through the tree? Well, just before he jumped, just after I turned him into a rabbit, I put myself in the magic hat. And then I just held on with one hand. And then you're probably saying to yourself, well, okay, I get that. But why don't you just get off him when he's a rabbit? Well, we've been through this. I was trying to impress a woman of attractive descent, and you can't do that on a rabbit. Not even a rabbit named Diablo. And then you're probably saying to yourself, well, why didn't you use the knife earlier? Well, two reasons. One, if I had, the story would be shorter, which isn't as useful to me. And second, you know, my Swiss Army knife is made by the Swiss engineers. You know, it has 74 useful functions. My brain was not made by the Swiss. It does not have 74 useful functions. If you want to compare my brain to something made by the Swiss, you might want to think about their cheese, you know, something soft and mushy with a lot of holes in it. So anyway, I turned him back into a horse. We went through the woods. He was in front of everyone now. He was happy. We finally broke out of the woods. We jumped some campers and some fires. And when we got to the exact place from where we started, Diablo stopped as abruptly as he had started. And I kind of went, huh. I would have flown off, except I had anticipated this. So earlier, I had reached underneath of him and tied my shoelaces together like a seatbelt. But I didn't want anyone to see me like that, so now I untied them. And then like half an hour later, the other horses came streaming in. And here was this woman on the front horse, and her blonde hair was blowing in the wind, and she jumped off the horse while it was still running, and she ran toward me, and she was like, oh, you are such a wonderful specimen of American cowboy manhood. You know, aren't you just the most amazing thing I've ever seen? Could I please supplicate myself to you? Can I be your woman? Now, I'm not quoting. That's just how I remember it. And then we kissed for the first time, me and her, not me and Diablo, for the first time a few days later on the Neil A. Armstrong elevator at the Tampa International Airport. So I went from the devil's back to the man on the moon, and that is how I met my wife.
Bill Lepp with his story, Diablo, or How I Met My Wife. It's fun to hear that story about Paula Lepp, Bill's wife. She's a good friend, too. Bill's story brought a memory to mind for me. I've never sat on the back of an unpredictable horse to impress a girl, but that's not to say I've never done anything to impress a girl. And the desire to win the favor of one's beloved doesn't end when the girl is won. I won the heart of my wife, Suzanne, and she won mine a long time ago. But just this year, I caught her looking at the back patio of the house a little thoughtfully. And when I asked her about it, she talked about the possibility of a screened-in porch back there. She'd always wanted one ever since she was a little girl. And, well, how would I feel about maybe building one? Well, there were 100 reasons not to do it. I'm okay with a hammer and saw. I mean, I can fix stuff that needs fixing around the house, and I can, put up a bookshelf pretty competently, and I can assemble furniture from IKEA with the best of them. But actually building a structure that people would actually spend time in, reading books or having a meal, a structure with walls and a roof that would keep the weather out, well, who knew if I could do that? But, well, I feel about my wife about like Bill Lepp feels about his. So away I went. And wouldn't you know it, over weeks and weeks, that screened-in porch began to kind of take shape. I went to bed sore every night. And when it was toughest, when I was up against a weird angle or a board I'd cut a quarter inch too short, I tried to remember who I was doing it for and how I felt about her. And it sounds corny, but it's love, I guess, that kept me going. I thought I'd fail a dozen times. That darned porch was pretty nearly my Diablo. But I didn't fail. That porch is there now. We sit out there just about every day. We read books and have meals out there. Suzanne talks every day about how much she loves it, and I love her. We never get over it, do we? The desire to impress our beloved, to make them think we're cool. And that's where Bill's story took me. Where will it take you, and who will you take along?
I want to introduce you to another show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Lisa Show, and it's hosted by comedian, believer, actress, single mother, Lisa Valentine Clark. The Lisa Show delves into the multitude of challenges and relationships that shape our lives, whether it's parenting, mental health questions, social issues. She and her council of moms will tackle it. She'll help you figure out this thing called life with a lot of laughs along the way. Lisa is a great person to hang around with. The Lisa Show. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, all kinds of places to listen to The Lisa Show whenever you like. The Lisa Show from BYU Radio. It's a pleasure to share with you on The Appleseed today, and we've got another story full of danger for you. It's called Hitchhiking, and it's brought to you by the delightful Geraldine Buckley from Maryland. Here's Geraldine, recorded live in the Appleseed studio.
It was the late 70s. I was 18, standing by the side of a road in Canada, a long way from home. I was wearing a blue circular uncrushable skirt and holding a sign that said, "The Border." I was about to put my thumb out and hitchhike for the very first time, and I was terrified. Now, you might be asking how I got myself into such a predicament. Well, I blame the whole thing on my mother. You see, my mother had a great love of adventure, but when she was 14 and growing up in Liverpool, the Second World War broke out, and England stayed at war until she was 20. So she said her best adventuring years were swallowed up by bombs and fear and rationing, and she was determined to relive them now vicariously through me. So while other mothers were urging their only daughters to read, to study, to go to college, my mother was saying to me, "Geraldine, darling, you study far too hard. Put away those books and go out and party." I wish it wasn't true, but it is. In fact, I am the only person that I know who got a master's degree out of sheer rebellion. So when I was 18, I told her I was going to go to the Olympic Games in Montreal with my boyfriend, and that we were going to hitchhike from Montreal to New York and fly back to England from there. Well, on that occasion, I wanted my mother to be like other mothers. I wanted her to forbid me to go, so I wouldn't have to, and I could tell her she'd ruin my life. But this was my mother, and she said, "Darling, I'll help you pack." So that's how I found myself standing by the side of a road in Canada with my thumb out and my knees shaking. But at least I had my boyfriend standing next to me. He'll keep me safe, I thought. My boyfriend, Ivor, was very respectable. He was 5 years older than me. He'd traveled extensively, so he explained the rules of the road. "Geraldine," he said, "you always wear good clothes. That way, you get a better class of ride. You never get in a vehicle where you're outnumbered, and when you're in that vehicle, you always chat to the driver to build a rapport. And if you do those things, you're less likely to be murdered." Murdered? I have a vivid imagination. I could just see my mutilated, murdered body being tossed out of the car on some outside some exotic American city like Akron. I pray, "Lord, please watch over me." And then I wanted to thank every car that whizzed past. But finally, an ancient two-door, rusted-out old Chevy skidded to a halt. Now, I could see through the open passenger window that the driver was alone, which was good. But he had long, unkempt hair, a missing front tooth, and dirt etched in the deep lines of his face. And he said, "I can take you 40 miles. And Ivor said, "Thank you, sir," and got in the back seat with the backpacks and whispered to me, "You get in the front, you're good at talking, build a rapport." So despite my misgivings, I had to get in. I reached for the seatbelt. It wasn't there. "Oh, it's no use looking for that," said the man. "That dropped off months ago." And he started that car. Well, it looked like a rusted out old jalopy, but he must have had something powerful under that hood because we went from 0 to 80 in seconds. And the man only had one hand on the wheel, because with the other he was chain smoking, and he was lighting the new cigarette with the burning butt of the old one. And he didn't have an ashtray. Now, it must be said, he didn't actually need an ashtray, because right in front of the gear stick there was a rusted out hole that went down to the road. And that's where he was flicking the ash and the still burning butts of the cigarette. Well, I was focused on that hole. I was waiting for a spark to hit the engine and the whole car to explode. And I was just thinking, there are more ways to be killed hitchhiking than I'd ever imagined. When the man said to me, "I've got a glass eye. Would you like to see it?" And he took out his eye and he put it on my shoulder. I froze. I didn't want that eye going into my lap or down by my feet. I didn't want the man grabbing for it, particularly not as we were going so fast. And then I slowly turned my head. And I wasn't quite sure what to say. I mean, what is the protocol when you're eyeball to eyeball with an eyeball? So I turned my head a bit further to see what Ivor's reaction was going to be, but he wasn't in the death seat. His eyes were closed. He was taking a nap. I finally managed, "That's fascinating," and that seemed to placate the man because he didn't say anything else until he dropped us off about 10 minutes later. But I was very relieved that from that point onwards he kept both eyes on the road, even though they were 3 feet apart. I was so grateful to get out of that car, so grateful. I watched it disappear until it was just a speck in the distance. But all that time, I felt that glass eye now back in the man's head, staring at me through the rearview mirror. But then I remembered something my mother had told me while she was helping me pack. She said, "Darling, don't worry." She said, "I've prayed, so everywhere you go on this trip, you'll be safe. Because the Lord, he'll keep his eye on you."
That was Geraldine Buckley with Hitchhiking. Have you ever unwisely found yourself in an uncomfortable situation? Did you ever do something you felt foolish about later? Those moments are part of growing up, and there are probably some stories there. What lessons have those moments taught you? We want to thank Bill Epp and Geraldine Buckley for sharing with us today. You've listened to their stories. Now it's time to share some of your own. The Appleseed is produced by me, Sam Payne, Wendy Folsom, Brian Tanner, and Kira Van Dam. Our audio engineer is DJ Cromarty, and the rest of the Appleseed team is Tristan Schetzel, Kay Hendricks, and Nico Wetzel. And if you like today's podcast, subscribe, rate us, leave us a review, and tell your friends. That's how the podcast grows. We also love to receive emails. Email us at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word. @byu.edu. Your thoughts and comments help us shape the future of the Appleseed. We're pleased and proud to be among the many podcasts produced by the BYU Radio family of shows. If you want more great storytelling for the whole family, then search for our companion podcast, Kaboom, where you'll hear original audio adventures for the whole family. You can find any episode of the Appleseed or Kaboom on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, on the BYU Radio app, or at byuradio.org. I'm Sam Payne, and we can't wait to be with you again on the Appleseed. Are you turned off by the news because of how angry and depressing it can be, but still want to engage with important issues? I know that describes me. And I want to introduce you to Top of Mind, another podcast from the BYU Radio family of shows. Each week, the Top of Mind team and award-winning host Julie Rose take one tough, important topic, and they dive deep. The goal is learning to stay open and curious when confronted with perspectives that challenge us. Best of all, every episode will leave you feeling hopeful and empowered to become a better advocate for what matters to you. Top of Mind. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, all kinds of ways to listen to the Top of Mind podcast from BYU Radio.